Welcome to the Fansmanship.com podcast, coming to you from San Luis Obispo, California.
Hot stuff.
Hi, everybody. It's Owen Main, and welcome to the Fansmanship.com podcast for Thursday. Today, we have a two-part podcast in store for you. The first part is a quick phone interview I did with J.D. Scroggin from the Tribune. J.D. writes the Slow College Beat, and that's incidentally his Twitter handle as well. J.D. and I talked about the upcoming Cal Poly soccer game at UC Santa Barbara and his hatred for the tortilla-throwing tradition that they have there whenever the Gauchos score a goal. We got into a little bit of women's soccer as well, and actually spent the most time also on football. Towards the end, we talked about the Cal Poly 6-0 start that they've had and whether or not an undefeated season is a possibility. I also talked to Andy Stevens, fellow Fansmanshipper, in the second segment. Andy is currently at an event for RC Remote Control Jets. It's called Best in the West. It's in the Central Valley, and it's kind of a hub for remote control jets and some of the best people who pilot those jets are there this weekend. And some of the jets are upwards of $10,000 or $20,000 as far as what people have put into them. So they're pretty big. They're pretty cool. He'll be posting from there, and he talked a little bit about what that event is like. And he's out there. So I hope you enjoy the Fansmanship.com podcast on Fansmanship.com. Don't forget, you can also find us on iTunes. You can give us 5 stars or something. You can find us there, download, subscribe to what we do. It definitely helps out. And we hope to have you back. Hope you enjoy Fansmanship.com podcast.
Welcome to the Fansmanship.com podcast. Owen Main here, and I'm pleased to be joined today. It's Thursday. I don't know what day in October it is. Is it the 19th, JD? Who knows?
Yeah, good question. I don't know. I work on weird times, you know. I turn my stories in a day in advance. They run in the next day's paper, and I put the next day's date on them, so I'm always, I never know what the date is. I just look at the computer.
That's what editors are for, though, right? So I'm here with J.D. Scroggin from the Tribune. J.D., of course, covers the Slow College Beat, and it's Thursday, so happy Thursday. It's kind of a big week, I think, in Cal Poly Athletics. There are two things I want to touch on with J.D. We'll get to football in a minute, but last time JD was on the podcast, we had quite a little conversation, and I got some knowledge dropped on me about the Cal Poly at UC Santa Barbara soccer game that happens every year. And this year, Cal Poly and UCSB are actually tied. They're tied for third place in the division, behind UC Davis and Sac State, going into what really is, I guess, the second round of the home and away series for the soccer teams, and Cal Poly gets to kick that off with a game at UCSB in Santa Barbara, and I guess they better hope they don't get any goals scored on them, right? Because otherwise we know what's going to come flying at them.
Yeah, it's a tough place to win if you're Cal Poly. I don't think they've got some streak there where they haven't won in quite a long time. I think that they might have a tie in there somewhere, but yeah, it's not been a place where Cal Poly has had much success in men's soccer. It's obviously at Alex Spanos, they've had a ton of success against Santa Barbara over these past 2 years, but just can't get over the hump when they go down to Harder.
Yeah, the Big West men's soccer to me is kind of an interesting animal because you have two divisions. You have a North Division and a South Division, two four-team divisions. And the division Cal Poly is in, I would call them, at least in kind of preseason and how they played before the conference, I would call them in Santa Barbara kind of potentially the favorites in their division. And yet, going into the last round of games, they were the two teams at the bottom of their division. And I think it's going to be interesting to see, especially when you get 3 points for a win and one for a tie in soccer, how quickly the bottom can get to the top and vice versa. In their division.
Yeah, well, this is the first year they've done the divisions, and I think maybe it's because they were adding was it Sac State, I think they added?
And Hawaii? Is Hawaii in there?
Yeah, Hawaii. You know, I'm not 100% certain. I haven't concentrated on that half of the division. I've only been paying attention to what's been going on with Cal Poly and UCSB. But you're right. You know, they have been at the bottom of the division so far, and you know, nothing really surprises you when you're talking about a sport where, you know, there's lots of and there's, you know, one and nothings, and you know, one goal can like separate the. It's the difference between a win and a loss, and pretty much anybody can beat anybody.
Definitely. I've been really impressed this year in talking with Paul Hollaher. I haven't interacted with him a lot before at all before this year, but I think it's really interesting when you hear a coach talk about style of play and it being important. I think you know, you hear like Coach Calero in basketball talk about, you know, kind of a slowdown style of player, or you can see that very easily. Cal Poly, it's kind of hard to see maybe for the non-soccer fan, but they really have adjusted their style of play this year, and I think I posted it like last week. They had already exceeded their goal total from last year when they had what was, you know, considered a pretty good and unlucky team. This year they've been playing what I think Hollaher would call like a more attractive style of soccer, where there's, you know, goals on both sides and kind of closer to maybe the international game.
Yeah, can you seriously not hear my baby bouncing in the background? He's going crazy on his bouncer.
I heard him say something, make a noise a few. I heard a baby noise maybe like a minute ago. But beyond that,
okay.
No, it's clear
okay.
As a whistle, JD.
I'm just wondering how this is not coming through because he's bouncing back and forth, screaming. He goes crazy in the mornings before I put him down for a nap. So, sorry to interrupt,
no,
but
you're
I just...
Good. You're good. You're good.
I can barely hear myself think.
You're fine. No problem. so let's talk about football, too. I wanted to get to that with you today. Cal Poly is obviously... Cal Poly is 6-0.
Wait. I thought you wanted to cover tortillas.
Oh, so tell me. Yeah, tell me about tortillas. I mean, I say
that... Are you going? Are you going to go? Have you decided whether or not you're going to go down to that soccer match yet?
I haven't decided yet, but if I do, I might try to get down close to the sidelines and get some mid-air tortillas if, you know, in the photos, if Cal Poly can... if Cal Poly gives up some goals, I don't know.
Yeah, it's kind of like a see it to believe it type of thing, you know? Like, it's I can't really even describe how horrific it is. You know, you've got, you know, it's not so much the you know, the students in the stands throwing tortillas at each other or other students.
Uh-huh,
you know,
uh-huh.
We get hit with a tortilla, what's going to happen? You know, what's the worst that can happen?
Right.
You know, you just get mad. You get embarrassed.
Right.
You know, dang you, and you shake your fist. But,
maybe a little flour.
It's... The ridiculous part about it, yes, they're flour, so they're a little softer, I guess, than corn.
Yeah.
But the ridiculous part about it is when they hit the field, they litter the field, and you know, you've got all of these, you know, I just like to call them foreign objects littered all over a Division I field of play. It really cheapens the whole, you know, the whole contest in my eyes because, you know, you've gone from what is, you know, one of the highest levels of soccer in the country to, you know, a really amateurish, you know, overall kind of event.
Yeah, they've been reaching the top 10 this year and
like all over the field.
You go from a top 10 team to, like you said, having something on the field. Do they clean up the tortillas, JD?
No. I mean, I've been there at a game before where there was an attempt made, you know, one of the Cal Poly players, I think it was Junior Burgos, you know, who was a national team player in his home country, you know, was shocked, I think, on the field when he saw all these tortillas flying along the field. He started complaining to the officials, and they made a small attempt to stop the game and try and clean them up, but then they just kind of gave up after a while. But, yeah, I mean, the game should be stopped and cleaned up. I mean, because you've got these foreign objects on the field. Someone can slip on them, you know. God forbid somebody twists an ankle or something and, you know, plants their foot cleat wrong on one of these tortillas and gets an injury. I mean, it could happen. It's not that far-fetched. You know, just you shouldn't, I think at this level, you should not have a situation where people are throwing things on the field. It's not only, you know, allowed, but it's quietly condoned by the host institution.
Right. Now, Now, are we talking like, you know, 10 or 15 tortillas, or are we talking like in the hundreds?
I got to say, it's kind of bizarre. It's kind of like you have to see it to believe it kind of thing. I don't even know if it's, you know, it's never more than 15.
Okay.
I don't know if you can even count them. It's like everybody, everybody in the student section all throwing tortillas. So, you know.
Wow.
Multiples.
Sounds pretty intense. Tell me this. As far as I was picturing, you know, you're talking about people slipping. I was picturing maybe somebody like going and the tortilla maybe covering up, you know, the sideline and the ref not being able to tell if the ball's in or out because there's a tortilla that the ball's resting on. I mean, there's all kinds of scenarios, right?
Well, yeah, they're mostly all over the sideline. They don't really reach the middle of the field, but they're all over the sideline. And it's usually when, you know, a goal is scored. So it's, UCSB scores a goal, boom, here come the tortillas. It kind of reminds me of that episode of The Simpsons where they were making, like, donuts or cinnamon rolls or something, and they take them and give them out at the game, and then they, oh, it's pretzels. It was the pretzels. And the Simpsons had a pretzel business, and they were giving out free pretzels at the baseball game, and then there's a bad ball in the field, and then everyone throws the pretzels and pummel the manager and knock him unconscious. And it kind of reminds me of. It reminds me of, you know, a cartoon.
Yeah. Well, what's not a cartoon is you know, the race. All four teams are within 3 points of each other, meaning that you could have a team that was 6 points back, which is two wins for your team and two losses for the other. You could also have all three teams still really close after this game if both teams tie, for instance, or something like that. So there's a lot of opportunity in the Big West North Division as far as soccer goes. And I'll mention here too that the women's soccer team at Cal Poly, while we're kind of talking soccer, is still undefeated in conference and quietly having a pretty awesome year in conference. Elise Krioff is ninth all time in single season goals. She's a freshman, and despite a lot of injuries, they've really had a nice year too. Have you had a chance to see very much of Alex Crozier's team this year?
I haven't, but they, you know, I've obviously followed them. It's hard to get away from a 6-0 football team, you know, to really do much else. You know, in other years when the Cal Poly football team is kind of up and down and maybe hasn't, you know, a front runner for a playoff berth kind of deal.
Yeah,
then I kind of spread the love around to some of the other programs. And, you know, I've tried to do that a little bit. I did it more so early on in the season when you know, the football season was just starting, and I kind of touch on all the programs. But lately, no, I haven't been able to break away from football coverage a whole lot. But, I mean, obviously keep an eye on what they're doing and you know, basically at this point, you know, looking like a dominant force in the conference, you know, it looks like a big return for Cal Poly women's soccer, who've had, you know, a lot of success in the Big West under Alex Crozier in his, you know, 20 plus years, I think, at this point. So it's not a surprise to see that they're doing well.
I kind of liken the situation there in some ways, and looking kind of at the up and down and the longevity of the coach, but then having, you know, a number of good recruiting classes. I kind of think of Crozier's program as maybe kind of akin to Faith Mimnaugh's women's basketball program too, you know, as far as having some success more recently here and having a couple of good, you know, recruiting classes and for a coach who's been there for a long time to kind of come back into the spotlight at Cal Poly.
Well, I don't know that I put them in the same class, because Alex Crozier has had success throughout his entire career at Cal Poly.
Okay. All right.
You know, it's not like they were, you know, the women's basketball program, just to be fair to the soccer, you know, they were pretty mediocre for about a decade before they were really able to make much noise in the Big West. And then they got Christina Santiago, and she was really, you know, the catalyst for them becoming one of the top teams in the conference. You know, prior to Santiago joining the team, they hadn't had a winning season under Faith Mimnaugh. They'd been 500 a couple times. They hadn't won a conference title. They hadn't, you know, gone to, you know, the conference finals you know, in the tournament and that kind of thing. Like, there was a lot of stuff accomplished while Santiago was here. So for that program, the women's basketball program, it's going to be interesting to see now that she's gone, you know, where does the level of the program now go? Does it remain one of the top in the conference or not? And women's soccer, you know, like I said, to be fair to Alex Kosher, I mean, he's been a coach of the year and several times, and they've won the Big West several times. So
okay, I wasn't sure, and
they've had sustained success.
Okay, so they've been a little bit more consistent throughout Crozier's tenure. So let's get over to football now, because I know that's what's dominating your time, and certainly dominating kind of the hearts and minds of a lot of Cal Poly Athletics fans. We have a 6-0 team in San Luis. We have a running back who is putting up some really huge numbers. I mean, at the beginning of the year, you would maybe think that Andre Broaddus, the quarterback, would be up for breaking some touchdown records, because that's how it's been. You know, when they get on the goal line, you know, it's been a Broaddus sneak right or left. We have a running back now at Cal Poly that is doing a lot more as far as finding a nose for the end zone. Deontay Williams with 3 touchdowns last week, and Cal Poly just kind of continues to roll. Talk a little bit about the game last week and kind of the season. I know you didn't get a chance to be at the game last week, but talk about what it's been like to cover a 6-0 football team.
Yeah, did you just drop a couple talkabouts on me right there?
That's for you.
I'd be remiss if I didn't point that out. Yeah, no, thank you.
Your favorite kind of question.
Yeah, of course. You know, now I know what it feels like. Yeah, I think to touch on Deontay Williams, I think what we're finding out is that he is a much more versatile running back than we've been able to see in the past few years at Cal Poly, because they've kind of had this mix of, Jake Romanelli, the big fullback, running up the middle, and then a guy like Mark Rogers, who's smaller and speedier, running on the outside.
Right.
And I think Deontay is kind of like a hybrid of both those guys, because he can run for tough yardage and he has the speed on the outside. So he's got, I think, 9 touchdowns this year and leads the team and ranked in the top 10 in the FCS in rushing yards per game, and rushing yards total.
Right.
So, yeah, he's been a huge key. And even though Broaddus' numbers have been down, both passing and rushing, what you look at when you watch him play and when you look at his numbers is that maybe he's not having as big an impact, you know, with the touchdowns as statistically as he did last year. But the team is averaging over 300 yards per game on the ground. They're ranked 3rd in the country in rushing yards, and that's due mostly to Andre making the right decisions in the option. You know, he's giving it to the right people at the right time, and Cal Poly is just kind of racking up the rushing yards, and that's a credit to him. You know, he's not being selfish and hogging the ball. He's giving it to the right guys at the right time. And
right.
If you look at his passing efficiency numbers, just efficiency, he would rank, I believe it's 4th in the FCS if he qualified for the minimum number of pass attempts per game, which is at this point 15 pass attempts per game, and he's averaging just under 12.
Yeah, I think he's gonna get to that.
Three more attempts per game, and he would be ranking, you know, among the leaders in the country in passing efficiency.
Right.
So even though he doesn't have the prolific type numbers, he's very efficient and really makes their offense go. So it's been fun to watch.
Yeah, Tim Walsh after the game talked about adjustments they make based on what he sees and a couple other of the veterans on the offensive side, and the offensive adjustments that they make, you know, halfway through the first quarter and in the second half, based on those reads. And I think it's what happens when you have a senior quarterback who has a number of years of starting experience and somebody who the coach trusts at this point with Broaddus, right? I mean, that's what I think Cal Poly fans were hoping for in a senior quarterback this year.
Yeah, he's doing what he was brought here to do. And if you check out the Tribune today, we had a feature on Andre, and it covers a lot of his background coming from Portland, and kind of bleeds into why he's been such an inspirational figure at Cal Poly. All with the backdrop of playing against Portland State this week, which is his hometown team. It's Tim Walsh's former program. You know, he was the head coach there for 14 years and helped them transition from Division II to Division I FCS. I had a nice piece earlier in the week also talked to him about his thoughts on the Portland State program, the direction it's gone after he left, you know, what his emotional tie is still. So it's going to be a pretty emotional game, I think, for a lot of people. There's a lot of Portland ties on the Cal Poly team,
right.
both with Broadus as a player and with several assistants and who played at Portland State, and Tim Walsh himself.
Yeah, I posted some post-game video of Walsh talking a little bit about that. I didn't post it till yesterday, but
I saw that
from Saturday night. He talked a little bit about it, and so did Andre. I went to the Wyoming game, like you know, and I was on your podcast afterwards. While I was down on the sidelines taking pictures at the Wyoming game, there was this guy who was about 6'4", 6'5", you know, just a tough, big-looking dude, taking pictures too. And he had a pretty sweet camera, and I was just kind of talking to him about you know, photography a little bit. And he had a Cal Poly shirt, and I introduced myself. And it turns out it was Stan Gross, Sullivan Gross's father, who was taking pictures there. And got a chance to talk to him a little bit. And you had an article that I read on the Tribune iPhone app today that was about Sullivan Gross. Talk a little bit about – here's another talk about question. Sullivan Gross, he was a linebacker when he came out of high school in the Fresno area. How has he transitioned from linebacker to really a dominant defensive lineman for Cal Poly?
Yeah, just to talk about the Fresno connection, I'm from Fresno originally.
Right.
I went to Fresno High at the Milwaukee Memorial. When I wrote the story about him, I sprinkled in some references to Fresno, obviously, because he picked up on it. And the first yeah, I picked up the story on the wire and ran it there. So I'm sure some of the Groves family and friends didn't present to see that. I thought that was kind of a cool thing for them. And I remember going back to signing day when they got Sullivan Groves. He was a guy, I think he had visited UCLA or visited Nevada. There were rumors out there that he, had received recruiting attention from a lot of, you know, much bigger schools than Cal Poly.
Uh-huh.
And I remember watching the video on signing day of this guy at linebacker. I think Walsh even mentioned at some point now, you know, we've envisioned him as a defensive lineman. It's kind of hard to watch the video, the highlight video of someone playing linebacker and then envision them playing lineman at the college level. But, I mean, Solon has really made a nice transition, and I think part of it is because he is tall. I mean, like you mentioned, 6'4". He was able to pack on, you know, some extra weight.
His father's 6'4", too, I think, so.
Sullivan. They're both tall guys, and I think he was able to stuff because of his height. Where maybe if he was 6'1", you know, he wouldn't be able to get to 280 pounds wherever he is now. And I think with the football instincts that he got as a middle linebacker, he has really developed those even further at defensive tackle. And it is kind of a weird transition. You know, you don't see linebackers go, you know, too often from high school linebacker to an interior defensive lineman. But it's a testament to just how talented Sullivan is that he pretty much right off the bat, after his redshirt season, was an immediate contributor for Cal Poly. I mean, I don't know if he started right away, but, I mean, he played a lot in his redshirt freshman season, and then he started ever since.
Got it. Tell me this, JD. Is an 11-0 season in the regular season, I think, you know, is it at this point, I guess, reasonable to think about as a Cal Poly fan?
Yeah, it's definitely in the realm of possibility. I think the tough games coming up on the schedule, are going to be Eastern Washington. People probably look at the regular season finale at Northern Arizona. Two road games that are going to be pretty tough. Against highly regarded opponents, ranked opponents. I wouldn't discount that Sac State game either at Sac State. I mean, those three road games are going to be tough to win. But, I mean, obviously, you know, with what Cal Poly has accomplished so far, it's not unbelievable that they could go in and compete with those teams and beat them. It's not a slam dunk by any means. I don't think anyone should be booking their trip to Frisco for the FCS national championship game right away. But it looks like Cal Poly every week. It's as long as they keep winning, it looks more and more likely that they're going to get a playoff spot. So I would probably bank on a return to the playoffs this year, first time since 2008. And if they continue to win, you might even see another home game in the playoffs here at Alex G. Spano Stadium.
Great. And at Eastern Washington, that's the red field, right? Like Boise State
yes.
has a blue field. Eastern Washington's is red, right?
Yeah, you can check it out. I'm sure it's on Google Earth. You can check it out and see that it's red.
It's kind of interesting. You know, Cal Poly's got to go up and play like in a dome, which isn't something you think about for FCS or smaller schools. But they'll be up there playing in the dome, and then also have to play on a red field. Just kind of interesting as far as the field surfaces go. What did you think? You were at the game at Weber State. What did you think about the gold uniforms? Were you a fan?
Actually they had white jerseys and gold numbers.
Okay,
I think
sorry.
Was the
white
deal. But the week final when they played at North Dakota, that's when they had all gold. They had a gold jersey and gold pants. And at Weber State they had white jerseys and gold numbers, and the announcer for the Weber State radio play-by-play was going crazy.
I
was dropping all kinds
of
stuff. He was dropping all.
I do my best. I just can't see anything. It was interesting.
Well, yeah, I'm sure he was PG on the radio broadcast, but behind closed doors in the press box, there's a few more obscenities and a lot of people in the press box got a big kick out of trashing the numbers that you couldn't see them. As someone who has to identify players by number itself sometimes for the opposing team, I mean, I could see how that would be annoying. I mean, I can usually tell the Cal Poly players just by their position and their body size, so it's, I don't really rely on the numbers a whole lot to tell who's doing what for Cal Poly. But it didn't really affect me, but I could see if the roles had been reversed and been Weber State with hard numbers to read, yeah, it would have been hard to know who was. So I think that was a big topic, especially early on in the game, the pregame and early on in the game, that you couldn't read the numbers. So I don't know if Nike's listening to the fansmanship.com podcast. I mean, those light on light or like colors for the jersey and the numbers that are hard to read are not popular among the media.
Especially the opposing team's media. Here with J.D. Scoggin from the Tribune. J.D., so what's your favorite? They've kind of sported three different away jerseys now for the first three games. What's been your favorite? The traditional one at Cal Poly with the white with the green letters, the white with kind of gold letters at Weber State, or the all gold jerseys that they sported at North Dakota?
The all gold was cool, but it was cool in like a novelty kind of way.
Right.
I don't know that that should be their everyday.
I totally agree
outfit.
I totally agree with you. And the thing about that is that I'm kind of, I guess, not flabbergasted by, but that's kind of confusing to me, is that they've chosen to use the alternate jerseys on the road. It seems like if you did alternate jerseys, you'd want to get your home fan base kind of pumped about them in some way, like Georgia does with their black jerseys sometimes or whatever. At home, that's the one place they've been consistent, and it seems like that would be the place that you'd want to kind of, rally your fan base to get excited about something like, different jerseys, right?
Yeah, well, maybe you can talk to Don Oberhelman about that and say, hey, fans might be willing to shell out some bucks for some alternate jerseys if they see them at home games. It might be something where they can, get some excitement about the new apparel and put it out in the Cal Poly store or stadium or.
Well, yeah, I mean, it just seems like
you
want to do that at the home games rather than the away games. But maybe there's something I don't know about that. Maybe they're not allowed to be different than green, or they don't want to go black or something like that, because maybe those are their only two options at home or something.
Well, I did talk to Oberhelman about the jerseys, and he said that black was the only thing he vetoed. He said that players wanted to go with black jerseys, black pants, or maybe all black color scheme, and he shot that down. He wants to keep it green and gold. And I think the reason it's been at the away games is because, you know, gold is a light color, you know, so if you're wearing gold and the road team's wearing white, it'll be harder to distinguish.
Right.
So,
you could make a deal with like UCLA and USC where they can either both wear one. I guess that wouldn't really work with light colors, but you tell the road team to wear their dark colors. Maybe there's an NCAA rule about dark and light and home and away. I don't know.
Yeah, you'd have to coordinate, but I don't know. It would be all, gamesmanship kind of thing, because I remember that USC-UCLA thing. I mean, there was, talk about it and are they going to let them do it or not, and then the coaches can kind of play mind games with each other. Well, like, no, we don't want to wear that, and then it just makes more hoopla than there really needs to be. So, I don't know. I kind of like Cal Poly's white-on-white road jerseys with the green accent. I think that's probably their best road combination, but it's also good for recruits, to get excited about different options for jerseys. I went to Fresno State and they had a jersey color scheme that was pretty much static for a long time. And then a couple of years ago, they changed to these different jerseys with a red helmet with a blue stripe, kind of triangular stripe going down the center. And I remember thinking, that's weird. That's dumb. That sucks. Where's the red, red helmet? That's what I'm used to. But for the recruits and the young guys that are just coming in, I mean, that's something exciting for them. Put on a new, jersey and a new helmet, and it's kind of cool for the youngsters to experience that. So I definitely get that side of it too.
Well, JD, I really appreciate you joining me today. I got to run, but thanks for joining the fansmanship.com podcast. And I think I'll see you Saturday, Cal Poly at home against their next opponent, who is Portland State. And Portland State will be in town at 6:05. It's homecoming week, so I am expecting a sold-out Alex G. Spano Stadium, and I'll definitely see you there.
All right, man. Thanks, Owen. I'll talk to you soon.
All right, take care.
So what is fansmanship.com?
Say what?
We're a sports website by the fans for the fans.
He wants to be a Laker.
For the Central Coast.
Catch the ball.
California.
The sweat-stained glitter Simmons wig.
And beyond.
Tim Tebow.
We love sports. Fansmanship.com. By the fans. For the fans.
Flashing clip-on nipple piercing and pink or purple tanning thong for absolutely free.
Yeah. Fansmanship.com. By the fans. For the fans.
We're joined now on the Fansmanship podcast by fellow Fansman shipper Andy Stevens. Andy, what's going on?
Fansman shipper, that's a good thing. I like it. We should coin trademark, copyright that as soon as possible. Yeah, out here in beautiful Buttonwillow, California, just west of Bakersfield, near the old runway. It was an old runway they used for crop dusters all over the place out here. And now it's kind of deserted, and the only time they really ever use it is when this event comes through twice a year, when some of the best RC jet pilots from around the world all meet here and talk their stuff.
So RC standing for remote control. Tell me about the California Jets and kind of what you guys, what you're doing there, kind of how you found out about it. This is your third straight year there, right?
Third straight year where I've gone four different times because they have two different events annually. One is California Jet, which happens in the springtime, and this one's called Best in the West, and it happens in the fall.
Got it.
And a lot of the same names that were out here last year are back again. A few new faces, so that's cool. It is 95 degrees out here, and well, my truck says 111, but that's because it's in the sun. But I check the Weather Channel. It's only about 95, which isn't so bad. But
your truck's crazy.
It is. My truck is insane. My truck has issues. Well, it's black in color, so it draws heat. So I would suppose that has something to do with it. But at any rate, yeah, a lot of the best from around the world are out here. We got Ali Machinsky from England. He comes usually every year. And Jack Diaz from Argentina is also here. He kind of brings his whole crew. So there's also a few guys from China this year that I have yet to meet.
Nice.
So I'm gonna see what they're all about.
Nice.
And yeah, so far so good. It's Thursday. I'll be out here till Sunday.
Good deal. Good deal. So so how did you hear about it? You have a friend who's kind of big into it, right?
Right. Right. Yeah. His name's Scott Steed, and he is the head technician for JetCat, which is the most popular company that makes these little turbine engines. JetCat USA is actually based in Paso Robles, and they handle all the engine and rebuilds and stuff like that for the entire Western Hemisphere. So they're based out of Germany. So JetCat USA handles South America and North America.
Awesome, and Scott does that. And is Scott the one that's been on our podcast before?
I'm sorry, say that again.
Is Scott the one that's been on our podcast before?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, he is. Yeah, he was the one here. He was a little bit shy behind the microphone. He kind of had to warm him up. Yeah, same dude.
Same dude, right on. And so you just got over there today. You said it's a, it's a four-day event?
A lot of the guys actually got out here and started setting up on Monday. The event officially started yesterday on Wednesday, and it goes until officially Saturday night. Then they have a banquet, and then Sunday everyone kind of packs up and leaves. A few guys stay all day, but the actual flying, where they kind of judge who's doing what based on the awards they give away at the end at the banquet on Saturday night, all kind of take place from Wednesday until Saturday. So yeah, I'll be coming home on Sunday.
Got it. Now, what kinds of different events? I guess if it goes multiple days, there's got to be a different plan for each day. So do they do just jets? Do they do helicopters sometimes? What's the situation there?
They do jets and they do helicopters, and what they do is they have specific categories that they will give awards for. Best, sport jet or best scale jet. Like, there's different categories that these jets have as far as how they build them, how the modelers build them. You can either have a sport jet, which is just kind of a creation that the modeler can make, or they have what are called scale jets, which are actually models of real actual jets that are just built to a certain scale,
right,
1/8 or 1/10 of the real scale of the jet. They also have helicopters. I haven't actually seen any yet. I don't think they come until tomorrow or Saturday. So, it's been going good so far. I've been kind of tagging along with Scott and seeing kind of the ins and outs, the real guts of these things. And there's a lot of intricate stuff to it, trying to understand how it comes together. You really take a look inside of one of these things, and there's literally hundreds of different things that have to go right. And if one thing goes wrong, you could lose, $10,000-$20,000. So it's quite science.
Here on the fansmanship.com podcast, I still have Andy Stevens with me. Andy is at a RC jet and aircraft show called Best in the West over in Buttonwillow near Bakersfield. I think Shafter's around there somewhere too, probably.
Shafter, yes.
Yeah.
30 miles.
Yeah. So Andy, what kind of jets are we talking about? Are we talking about jets that, how fast do these things go?
The model called the Viper gets up to probably about 230 at its peak. That's pretty much the fastest one. They have these other ones that are called Victories, which are actually my favorite model. They're kind of the bigger, slower, majestic-looking one. It's a passenger jet. It's an actual jet. It's a scaled jet. So they actually do have these. It's, what do they call those? C4 or C5, the smaller private jets that they have. And one of them is called the, those can get down. So they bring those things down to 30, 40 miles an hour. It looks like they're barely moving. So, but the Viper gets up to 230 miles an hour. It's quite a thing to see these guys, the best in the world, they bring them by on these passes. They can get them going that fast, going literally only about 10 feet off the ground, inverted.
Andy, we're having some technical difficulties again here, so are you there? Can you hear me?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I was totally losing you there. So you were talking about the jets getting inverted only 10 feet from the ground. What would be the point of a RC jet flying 200 miles an hour? It just seems like you would just maybe fly it around in circles, because otherwise you're going to lose sight of the thing and you're going to lose it, right?
Yeah, well, these guys are really good at sending them out there. I mean, they send them out pretty far after their passes, and they bring them back up in the air, and they get them so far out there that sometimes you can barely see them. But they know how to, they were so experienced that they know exactly how to turn them and bring them back, and then they run past only about the ravine out there is probably a good 1,000 yards away, and they can see them as they bring them, back through, and then turn them again and bring them back right in front of the crowd. So it's quite a thing to see. You know, there's so many intricacies to these things, and it's that kind of like a private club in a way. There aren't really too many of guys around the world that can fly these things quite like these guys can. So again, it is really something to see.
So that being said, how many people attend to watch or to participate? How many people are they expecting out there?
As far as fans showing up, the peak day is Saturday. That's when most people come out. That's when they, have jets that they put this certain oil in, where they'll do like smoke shows. They even have sets of fireworks out there where it kind of looks like they're, going through, a bunch of bombs going off in the air, kind of a simulation of a war or something like that. They have these war jets that they have. As far as total people out here on set, probably a good 600-700 people, I would say, total. And this is to watch a total of probably about, I'd say, 30 pilots, something like that. So,
but these pilots really are some of the best pilots in the world, and I think that's pretty interesting to get them all in one place and to have that be in California. I mean, I guess it makes some sense. You said the weather's pretty hot over there. Is it windy? And how does the weather play into what kind of tricks they're able to do?
It is not windy at all. It is actually weather counts as 95 degrees. It does feel all 95 degrees, but it's a dry heat. And actually, speaking with a few of the guys, just based on other events that they've been to, like, I'm done talking with a guy that came from Kentucky, and he was commenting on how it seemed like his engine wasn't working quite as well as it does. It was eating a lot more fuel, basically not getting going as quickly as back home, and that has a lot to do with how humid it is back there, and that really helps the intake of the jet. So it's definitely different than back there, but they do have an event back in Kentucky, kind of like this. It's called Kentucky Jets, go figure, that takes place in the middle of the summer. So, they bring them into California from all around the world, but they also have, like I say, Kentucky Jets. They have Florida Jets, one in Florida, in the springtime. So, there's a few events like this around the country. It's kind of a travel tour these guys do. So, yeah. Pretty cool thing.
Right on. Couple more questions. One, you are going to be posting pictures, right, on our Facebook page, and hopefully tweeting some pictures and some updates from there this week?
Absolutely. The guy, this whole hot spot.
Can you say that one more time for me?
Yeah, absolutely. The guy that sets this whole thing up has a hot spot out here that he has set up, so everybody be a problem, even though we're out here in the middle of nowhere. We all do have internet, so that is a plus.
Oh, cool.
Posting right pictures.
Right on. And if people want more information about either Best in the West or California Jets, where should they go?
CaliforniaJets.com, Best in the West Jet Event.com, I believe, is the web for this one. And again, it's an annual thing. The more the merrier. It's very inexpensive. I think tickets for the public are only like $5-$10 or something like that, and that's an entire weekend pass. And there are fans actually do come in from all around the country. Like my friend Scott was commenting that there's a guy that comes and talks with them that is kind of an enthusiast that kind of travels around to all these events. He's a big fan, and he just he commented to me. I saw that guy at Kentucky Jets and at Florida Jets earlier this year. So, $5 to $10 gets you in. They do bring in people from all around the world, even fans. They stay in hotels just down the road. So it's kind of the biggest thing Button Willow has going for it. It's a little farm town.
Are you staying in a hotel? What are your accommodations like? Do people camp out?
We actually have an RV this year. I'm sitting now surrounded by a few dozen RVs. In years past, we have stayed in hotel rooms. It was pretty cool because Jet Cat was able to spring for those, so all our accommodations were paid for. But this year, we do have an RV coming in, one of our friends, so we won't have to leave and drive back and forth from the hotel. It's about a half-hour drive each way, so... that's a plus.
Very good, very good. Well, Andy, have a good time, and we'll be looking for the updates on the Fansmanship Facebook page and also the Twitter page, and I'm sure you'll have at least a couple of posts about stuff that's going on out there. So thanks again,
yeah.
and we'll catch you later on down the trail.
Thank you for listening to the Fansmanship.com podcast. For more news, opinions, and podcasts, go to www.fansmanship.com.
Well, I've been stuck on down in Trouble Town. It's a lonely place, it's true. Street lights so bright they blind my vision. And the people on the streets, they beat me up till I'm black and blue. Signs out on